Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Hey guys, welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast.
So I'm here in Oddbox HQ.
I had a nice cycle ride, a good hour and a half to get here to be with you, but I'm very excited. I first heard about you from a friend, and then like a month later you were doing your seeders round, so I was pretty happy to be an investor, and then I've just been following your journey ever since, and really nice to have the time with you today to find out a bit more. Yeah, you've really taken off around London. Most of the offices I go to, well, a lot of them seem to have you guys, so it's good that you're having an effect. But I guess I'd like to know a bit more about you initially, like where you guys came from. So can I have like a quick sort of 2 minute story from each of you about like before up to like meeting each other?
Okay, so I'm originally from France, and Deepak and I actually met in India when just after doing an MBA in France, I had my first job in India, and we were colleagues before being partners, and now back to being both partners and colleagues. And so my background is originally in finance.
And I've lived most of my life in India. I did my MBA in finance, and then we started off corporate finance. And like most Indian parents, you know, the journey they ask you to take is be an engineer or a doctor or work in this prestigious organization, preferably a multinational, buy a house, buy a car, get married, have kids, and followed a formulaic life for most of my life. I was at 3M, which is a multinational company, which is where I met Emily in corporate finance. And this was about probably 16 years ago now. Seems like a lifetime.
Yeah, wow. Did you guys start dating straight away? Do you remember the first time you met?
Well, I mean, I think the first time I remember this really vividly, actually, because when Emily first came from France, she had this really strong French accent.
Which I actually still have.
You still have? Yeah. But, you know, she's got a bit more of an Indian French accent now. And I really remember going to this meeting room with my manager and hearing Emily, I literally couldn't stop laughing. And this coming from an Indian guy who's got a strong Indian accent as well. So a critical moment, but nevertheless.
I made a strong impression.
She made a strong impression, let's put it that way. And she had like mosquito marks on her, I think, eyes it was. And it was hilarious actually to see this girl who's really, obviously, super passionate. But at the same time, she's got this funny accent. She's got her face all puffed up as well. Yeah, it was all good fun. Yeah. She made a strong impression. That's the right word.
We were actually colleagues for over a year before we started dating.
Yeah, I did try a lot, though. I kept taking her out to the bars after work and trying to kind of, you know, I wouldn't say force-feed vodka, but pretty much.
Cool. And then from there, the relationship just sort of blossomed, and you guys, like a fast thing before you decided to get married, or like many years?
So I was in India overall for 5 years, and so we moved to the UK because Deepak had moved to a different company, and then got a job in London, and that's how we came here 10 years ago now. So it's been a while, and so at that time, Deepak had moved to an IT company and was working mainly in banking, so financial services.
I'd always known that I wanted to move to the UK or the US, and mainly because of the work-life balance. Because I think in India, what happens is that, yes, you have a lot of opportunities with respect to work, but there's not much of the work-life balance that I was yearning for in terms of weekends. What do you do? And I used to end up working weekends as well, just because A, we were in a multinational company, B, we were in finance, and as the nature of the job goes, there's just a lot of work that needs to be done.
And I think it's also kind of the Indian culture. Yeah. In some way, it's quite similar to the French culture, where it's quite hierarchical. And actually, you don't want to leave before your boss leaves. Plus, there's a tendency to take a lot of coffee breaks, lunch breaks. And so the actual work tends to spread to a bit longer than kind of a 9 to 5.
It starts at 3 p.m. and then ends at about 8 p.m., 9 p.m. But in a way, it's good because you are having this kind of social gathering. You speak to your colleagues over lunch and over coffee rather than it being a very functional relationship with work, and that's great. But what happens as a fallout of that is you end up, you know, staying really long, yeah. you know, and spending most of your time at work, which means there's not much of family time. So I think it's a bit of a throw up there to say what is the right thing to do, which is why I decided I like working and all that, but I really like the freedom of being able to do things beyond work, you know, in the evenings or weekends. So that's what brought me to the UK.
Cool. And then how long was it before you started Oddbox then? Like another 5 years of working?
Yes, probably 5-6 years before we actually started Oddbox. When I moved to the UK, then I wasn't working. I found a job quite quickly, again in finance. And then I really wanted to do something with more purpose. And so I had been looking into moving into the charity sector, and I got an opportunity 2 years later to move into a finance role and eventually kind of became director of finance and operations for a charity focusing on girls' empowerment in developing countries. So for me, I didn't want to have kind of work where I was earning money and then a separate life where I was having a purpose. It was very much about how do I integrate doing something good with my day-to-day work. And so, yes, Deepak was kind of at that time working in financial services. And
I think for me, going back to the Indian parents, you know, it was really for me as an Indian, I was quite proud to be working in the city, a square mile, and earning a lot of money. So that was at that point in time, that phase in my life, it seemed like the right thing to do. When your parents say, oh, they're proud that the son works in the city. And that was really good. But I think what I found over the years working in the city was that I was having to deal with a lot of, shall we say, alpha kind of population, everybody trying to out-talk the other person, maneuver the other person. And B, I'd come from this culture where, you know, I was talking about the social interaction with colleagues, whereas in banking, it was very functional. It was getting the job done. And you never necessarily got a pat on your back because you were paid to get the job done. And what was also happening on the back of that was, I remember, you know, having these tough meetings, it would be a global call, fairly brutal in terms of people saying, I need that done by X amount of time. And me really feeling run down by the afternoon and me just going for a walk in the city. It might seem a bit hollow, but buying stuff, thinking like buying a new suit or buying new things, thinking buying new things would actually fill this hole of some sort. And this hole started getting wider and wider. And me getting to a point where I thought, what am I doing? Why am I working almost 12 hours, spending 8 to 12 hours of my day at a place which I really don't enjoy? And I'm still in touch with those people from my banking days. Don't get me wrong. The people are nice. It's just the environment. Mm-hmm. What am I doing? Just earning money. Spending, because there's this hole which is forming.
Yeah.
And I had no idea of how to fill the hole. So I was trying mindfulness. I was always passionate about going to the gym and doing some activity. So that was happening at the same time. I was trying to fill this gap. I just got to a point where I think we'd gone to Colorado to see my sister one December. And I just, the penny just dropped. I think it was December 2014, if I'm not wrong, where I went, what am I doing? You know, so I think by Jan, Feb, my mind was all set on, I don't think this is the right thing for me to do. And I'd kept switching different banks to think, maybe the other bank is better. Maybe this bank is better. Maybe it's just, you know, the project which is not good or the team which is not good. But at some point, I think the problem or the solution was with me, was within me. It was not external. So I had to fix that. I'd remove myself from the situation rather than get more and more negative about that whole equation. So because I didn't want to be negative. So the solution had to be found somewhere else, which was within me. So I had to remove myself from the equation and remove myself from banking, which is what happened.
So did you step out of banking completely without a plan?
Pretty much.
We had a few discussions and I was more, why don't you do something part-time? But then, yes, for Deepak, it was, he can do only one thing at a time or concentrate on one thing at a time. So that part-time option was, he knew that wouldn't work for him.
And I think there was, when I spoke about this with my friends and my family, it was generally people went, why are you doing this? Have you thought this through? You have a mortgage? So all these questions and people sowing the seeds of doubt right in your mind. almost telling you that you're actually making a wrong, incorrect decision there.
It's not easy kind of when your kind of job is actually a big, big part of who you are. And whenever people will ask you, you say, I'm Emily and I work there. So your identity is very much tied to your job. And so it's difficult to kind of move away from that. So we discussed it quite a lot. And Deepak was quite brave in saying that didn't work for me to just do part-time. We had enough to pay our mortgage. So actually, the risk is quite limited. And there's always an option to go back to work. That decision is irreversible and has long-term consequence.
And, you know, brave or foolish is a good question at that point in time because I didn't have a plan. So that's pretty foolhardy to kind of do that. Thinking back now, that naivety was actually good because I didn't have almost that fear of, oh, what happens? Or if here's a clear plan, got it all figured out. What happens if the plan failed? And I didn't have that fear of failure because I didn't have a plan. So I was almost naive to say, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know I'm not going to work in banking. And almost at that point in time, I was clear. I didn't want to work for someone. And I think that was clear in my mind. Everything else was just up in the air.
And it's not that you ended up doing nothing. You then had found a program, an entrepreneurship program that you could join to kind of figure out what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I'd found one of my friends, she had mentioned Escape the City, which was essentially they had their startup school, which is really brings people together, mostly ex-bankers and lawyers who want, again, to make this career move either to another startup or a charity or to start their own company. And I remember quitting in March and joining this program in April. And it was really good timing, actually, because A, it taught me the basics of how do you build your own website? How do you market on social media? Which I had absolutely no clue on at that point in time. And B, it put me in touch with this network and ecosystem. And that was the first time I was actually seeing that in action of how communities can really work together and collaborate together. I found that a watershed moment in the sense that to understand that is how communities work and people quite selflessly help each other and want to help each other. Because at this point in time, mind you, I was working in banking. It was all functional transactional relationships. And for me, that concept of someone helping you and giving their time without expecting anything in return was really, I would call, a transformational moment for me. And then this human connection and interaction is something very powerful.
It's really like so much about networks and having each other's back, helping each other out. It's so nice in entrepreneurship when you are doing something useful.
At the same time, I joined a similar entrepreneurship program, which was quite different. So it was good to be able to share that learning from both the programs. Yeah. And kind of, that's how Oddbox started. Deepak was focusing on something else initially. But to be able to kind of share what was different about the two programs and what was beneficial in each of the programs. And also, we had been in the corporate sector for all our working lives. We knew very little about entrepreneurship. We didn't have many friends who were running their own business. So it was something completely new for us.
So you had the idea for Oddbox? I mean, how did that part come? So you guys were just like brainstorming different ideas at home, or?
There was a bit of frustration from us in terms of the food industry and the produce that we could get in the UK. The fact that, first of all, everything is packaged. You can get everything all year round, which is quite amazing. But then things out of season don't taste great compared to what you get in France or even in India, where you don't get it all year round. In India, you get mangoes only 2 months a year. But then the mangoes taste amazing. Produce are ripe. In France, it's similar. You go to the market and you get amazing produce. And so that was something that we had in the back of our mind. And then at that time, there's a French supermarket who launched a campaign on imperfect fruit and veg. And we thought, oh, that's amazing. Why can't we get imperfect fruit and veg in the UK? Because we actually don't really care how they look. At the end, you just cook it and then you get produce which are in season. You do something good. And that's when kind of it was at the same time as the program. So that kind of program helped us develop that idea and the business model. But at the same time, the idea came from really kind of seeing that being done somewhere else.
And I think we visited your I think parents in Portugal as well, yeah. And you saw the street markets and you see the produce there, ugly, nothing perfect about them, but the taste is completely different.
Yes. Yeah.
And you go, why is it, what happens to these produce? What happens in the UK? Why is it everything, you know, almost like in a beauty contest, right? I mean, you see everything's laid out perfectly. And I think it was a mix, a few different things happening almost at the same time, which almost led to that idea coming to fruition.
Because it's easy to have an idea. You can have a lot of different ideas, but then executing on the idea is the difficult part. And initially, when you start a business, you think, oh, I need to protect my idea. But in fact, the idea for Oddbox, probably 100 more people had the same idea at the same time. So it wasn't an innovative idea, but the program helped us develop that idea. And at the same time, Deepak was kind of working on more of a fitness idea, which he was doing some program for to promote fitness for the Indian community. So kind of online. And Oddbox was starting to pick up. And obviously, it's moving fruit and veg. So it's quite heavy in terms of the logistics. And I was working at the same time. So it was, Deepak was helping me going to get the produce from the suppliers. So we had a few suppliers working at the wholesale market. So we would go on Saturday early morning at 5 a.m. when the market was about to close. And then we would pack the boxes and deliver ourselves. So he was very much involved kind of from the start. And slowly we got more traction with Oddbox than his fitness project, and he became involved full time. It's just serendipity that it was the right timing that he had quit his job, and therefore he had time to help, and that's just this idea which picked up. It could have been the opposite.
And I'd qualified to become a personal trainer at that point in time. And I was doing these kind of fitness sessions in the park, at the same time running this kind of Facebook-based online community. And then when Emily had launched, you know, what used to be called Tasty Misfits at that time, we needed a place to pack. So I was scouting the local churches because I was thinking, hold on a minute, churches got so much space. What do they do with this space, especially early hours in the morning and nighttime? And could we get the benefit of that space and give them fruit and veg in return? We can't pay them money, of course. Yeah. And surprisingly, I spoke to quite a few churches in the Palam area where we live. And funnily enough, one of the churches, which is on the same road where we live, he said, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you use the space? And that became our first pack house.
It was more a community hall than a proper church.
Yeah, exactly. But that was a great, because we were literally storing, before the church, we were storing the fruit and vegetables in our fridge and on the terrace because it was winter. Yeah. We literally had no space and we didn't have the money for a warehouse for sure.
It was very much bootstrapping from the start because for us, that was our idea of how you build a business. You can do everything you can yourself with minimal cost. So we were buying our packaging kind of unbranded, just putting some stickers on top of it so that people knew that it was
cheapest possible
it
box.
Was from us.
The stickers, I think the look for first logo was probably what, 30 pounds?
Yeah, 30 pounds. We got somebody on Fiverr to make our logo. But actually, it didn't matter that much. And sometimes people think that you need to have everything perfect, that you need to have a brand agency, do your logo, your branding, your marketing. And for us, also, I guess, because we didn't have that marketing background. So we thought at the end, we just want to see if there's a market, if people would be willing to buy this imperfect produce. And so let's just try it. So we got some leaflets printed that we distributed ourselves in our neighborhood, went to some local fairs and put a bit of free posts on Facebook. And that's how we got our first customers, first 20 customers,
I think it's
first
a great,
some of our friends.
Would you say it's a great, suppose, learning for us that if you are truly genuine and authentic, the packaging and the looks and all that don't matter as much?
I think if you're solving a real need, because for us, we felt that it was a need because we knew that we would be happy to buy this produce. It was less packaging. It was solving an issue of food waste. And so we thought if that's something that we would be happy to do, there's definitely going to be people like us who will be happy to get their produce directly from the growers and get the produce that they are not able to sell, which are still perfectly good quality, but don't meet supermarket specification. And I think it's probably maybe the best way of testing that there's a real need, because we got customers, people still wanted it. And then you can beautify your proposition and add the branding and the marketing and the packaging and everything. But if at least you're able to get some customers with a basic service, then that means you can only improve on that.
Because the pictures on our website as well, I remember.
We were taking them ourselves.
I think it was firstly with an iPhone in the park. But in hindsight, it was literally that on the website and people still bought it. And we didn't get a food stylist for sure. Now we've got a great marketing team who then focuses and works with food stylists, works with special photographers.
But we still do a lot. Most of our photos are taken by a brand marketing lead who's a great photographer. So it's always been about trying to make the most of what we have.
And we focus more on the stories, the messaging and the impact rather than the pure aesthetic. In a way, you could say that because we're Oddbox and we're all about being imperfect, you don't need to be perfect. And the substance is more important than the style in other ways.
Yeah. And it feels more authentic as well. Mm. So we put a letter in the box, which is still written by our head of operations. So he's a great writer.
From day one.
He's been writing the letter. I think, Deepak, you wrote maybe the first letter and then he took over because he felt that he could write it better.
For sure.
And so for the past 3 years, he's been writing the letter.
And customers love that. Yeah. You know, every single person talks about the mission and all that, but the letter, which started off as a simple idea.
And talking about what's happening in the fresh produce industry.
Which is fascinating.
About what's happening on the farm, how growers are impacted by the weather, the different type of produce, what's in season, provide tips. So it was very much about kind of what value can we add beyond just the fruit and veg? Because we've also discovered, because we're not from the industry, we've discovered so much. How can we share all of the things that we've discovered? And Gavin is amazing at writing it. He loves doing it and he's good at doing it. People like his style because he's got more knowledge of the fresh produce industry because he was doing all of the sourcing at the start. He's got more to share about the stories.
So you had quite good growth in year two, but then that was enough to prove that you should be raising a round, or was it more like people's faith in the idea rather than the growth? Because I remember just sort of reading it and being like, yeah, this is super awesome, I'm investing.
So we closed the year with 600 customers and then we got really good press features in December and January. And we grew from 600 to over 1,000 customers just in January.
Yeah.
And so that proper traction was enough to be at a stage where we could get angel investment. But it was still very much kind of individuals believing in what we were doing.
I think if I'm not wrong, we were approached by one of our customers who is also an angel investor who said, are you thinking about funding? And I think Emily is right. I think when we reached that 1,000 customer mark, that's when we started attracting people's attention. And for us, it made perfect sense to reach a scale in order to be able to have that benefit.
Yeah. And we had been accepted into the NatWest Accelerator. And so we were now surrounded with people who were at similar stages and were at either just raised investment or were thinking about raising investment. So I think there's some benefit as well in being with people who are at a similar stage, because that opens up possibilities.
Mm.
We might have been able to raise investment earlier, but we just didn't know or didn't think about it.
Mm.
But being surrounded with people who were also trying to build a business and were also kind of starting to get traction, then we realized that there was some potential with Oddbox.
And it helped us, took us a long time to refine our pitch and our story and things like that, because we're always thinking about, we've done this, we've done that. but not really thinking from an investor's standpoint as well. So that really helped refine the story we were trying
to tell. And prepare to approach how to go about raising investment. We didn't have a network in the UK, so it was all about learning how that angel funding process works.
And it's great because there were some really tough but relevant questions as well about the business model and testing us. Because when you run the business, it's quite hard to step back and think, oh, 3 years down the line, this is what might happen when you go nationwide, for instance. And there were all these tough questions that we were being asked, which in the initial discussions, we didn't have the answers to. So it helped us refine and think about those.
Think about more long-term and long-term the strategy.
And also expand our vision. Yeah. Because somebody would tell us, oh, why don't you go pan Europe? And we would have never thought about that. We were still, you know, how do we expand in London territory? So I think that the process is quite critical, I think, to help you refine your idea and your business model, because you don't figure it all out. You are making it up as you go along. You didn't have it all figured out. That surrounding yourself with investors, entrepreneurs, and mentors at the same time, and having that ecosystem helps you shape your idea and shape your model as well to move forward, which is where you understand whom do you hire at what point in time, which is, again, the next critical step as well. Because I think once we had raised our crowdfunding round, then it was about deploying those resources most efficiently. Which
that's then quite a big task, that now you've got all that money, that you need to think about how do you use it effectively. Yeah. You've kind of told your investors that you're going to deliver all of that growth, because obviously you prepare a financial model who's always a bit kind of overstated and ambitious, because you need to show that you're going to grow fast. But once you've got the funds in the bank, that you need to actually think quite carefully about how you use it effectively.
And I think because of the mission and being in the right place at the right time, the focus on sustainability, the focus on plastic and so on, we've been able to attract some really, really high quality people without, you know, us going out of the way and, you know, doing a lot of marketing. Mm. And to a big degree, again, that's helped us, you know, get to where we are now.
What's helped is that our background in a corporate environment, managing teams, recruiting teams, means that we know also how to select the right people. Mm. So before starting Outbox, we had 15 years experience. So that helps as well in some ways in knowing how to structure the business, knowing how to bring and recruit people, incentivize people, build a culture. Mm. So all of these things are kind of normal for us to do. So there's always something that you will need to learn anyway. You can't know everything. Mm. We were quite complementary in some of our skills as well. And I think you could run a business on your own, but then having a co-founder is invaluable, because there's always times when you're like, oh, I don't think it's working out, so maybe we should just stop. And you're never at that same stage at the same time. So there's always one person who's kind of at a peak.
Yeah.
And when the other person is slightly down.
And this is the thing, right? Everybody talks about the glory of entrepreneurship. Nobody talks about the flip side of that argument, where there's so many setbacks, failures, dark days as an individual, right? Where you go, oh, why am I doing this? And I do feel there are some days when I just want to take a mini sabbatical, so to speak, just go off and take a digital detox. And I've done that in the past. You know, I took a couple of weeks off to India and did this 1 week in an Ayurvedic kind of ashram, or not an ashram, but Ayurvedic kind of place, where I just didn't take my mobile. It was me, books, Kindle. And it's really refocuses you, re-energizes you, but also sets perspectives, right? And it's not like that's it. Okay, I feel that need every year or
and two. I think now that we've got a bigger team, we can do a bit more of that. But at the start, it's tough, because then you cannot do everything and you need to be on calls all the time. And also, even after you raise investment, it's not that you've got that much more time. It's not that you can pay yourself a lot. So for a long time, we were not paying ourselves. We're still not earning a lot. So people shouldn't start a business with the hope that they are going to make a lot of money, but because actually there's quite a slim, very slim chance of us making a lot of money. But what we love is kind of what we're creating.
And the learning process as well.
And the learning, you know, and learning, the development. And trying different things and failing and then improving. And so all that is the really exciting part.
And the flexibility and the freedom as well, you know, working with people, you know, if it's almost like we're trying to create a culture where, which is anti the culture we were before. But it's quite hard to do that at the same time as when you're growing really fast. You know, how do you balance performance
and still staying true to why we started Oddbox and having kind of so we're in the process of becoming a B Corp, because for us that means that it will give us some guidelines and a framework to always stay true to our mission and despite getting investment to balance the fact that, yes, obviously we need to be financially sustainable, and being financially sustainable means we can help more growers and bring Oddbox to more consumers and solve a bigger proportion of the issue of food waste. So there's always that balance of about kind of the ethics and the financial sustainability.
So in terms of where you're going now then, what are your kind of plans for the next 5 years? And do you want to start like sort of meal boxes, like ready meals and stuff from waste, or like go to Europe or just the UK? What's going on?
If people think about sustainability, then Oddbox should be the first product that pops up into people's mind in the UK as well as in Europe. We have been approached by people following our crowdfunding, but even recently in Europe to expand Oddbox. So from a product side, there are things that we could do beyond just the food and veg in a box, which is derived products like juices and things like that. But also beyond food and veg, we have tried food products where there's best before date kind of challenges that people have. And there's a risk of those products going to waste. So there's an element of that as well. That
yes, being able to help other brands sell anything which is kind of short dated or mislabeled or kind of wrong packaging.
So any food product that stands at the risk of going to waste, that could form part of the Oddbox as well. But beyond the kind of Oddbox consumer product being number one kind of sustainable product in Europe, we also have the supplier side. There are quite a lot of opportunities there. It works on how do we know what waste or surplus a supplier has? We literally have to pick up the phone and ask them. And if we could build a tech-enabled marketplace, which then makes that information transparent, can we find different sales channels for the suppliers as well?
Yeah, so we think there's quite a lot of opportunities to address the food waste issue.
We found that from customers that they buy Oddbox because they feel like they have an impact on climate change and the resources that go into growing the produce. So what we're doing now is we're building this impact model, which then quantifies the resources in terms of water resources that went into growing a particular type of produce, the carbon footprint to grow it and also transport it from A to B, and any other kind of metrics that might be relevant, and really making that customized and individualistic in a way so that people can log into their account and see what is it that they are having an impact on.
Yeah, so that they kind of know that every time they receive an Oddbox, how much of resources they've saved.
Yeah.
And also, once they have that insight and the data, then it becomes more difficult to waste it. Once you know how many resources have gone into growing one apple, then you're a lot more
mindful
about not wasting. So it's very much changing mindset and changing behavior, helping people change their behavior by providing the information and the data.
And that's on the kind of scientific aspect. And there's also the education aspect of what are growers kind of pains, what are they going through? We had a mild winter this year. What's the impact of that? If you have a wet spring, what's the impact of that on the food system? So I think there's a big untold story there about what's happening behind the scenes at a farm level, the food supply chain. And I think all of us are beginning to kind of wake up to that. I really want to know where my food comes from. How is it transported? How did it get here? And we're beginning to gain knowledge because we have a lot of interaction with our growers and suppliers. That information that Emily was mentioning before and the education aspect is where we think behaviors will change and mindsets will shift. And we could almost use Oddbox as a medium to help enable that final goal.
Yeah, essentially, if you think about most things, there's a complete connect of what is that happens, but climate change is like, there's this whole like sort of mystery stuff. Right. And then you're like, you don't see what the bad thing is from like throwing away your apple. There's nothing that lets you know what you're doing right or wrong.
I think sustainability is just this big cloud, which everybody uses, oh, we are sustainable, but nobody actually sits down and defines what does it mean? Does it mean local? Does it mean buying tomatoes grown in a greenhouse in the UK. In the UK and some Scotland, or is it better to get tomatoes from Spain grown in natural conditions? From our perspective, what we know, we're trying to kind of package that and say, okay, you know, this is what, in our view, sustainability means, is being long-termish, you know, efficient utilization of resources. I think that's the key underlining kind of thing. As long as we efficiently utilize our resources and we consciously consume, then, you know, that is, well, I wouldn't say the definition of sustainability, but part of that big cloud.
Yeah, and we want people to feel empowered to do something, because sometimes it feels like the climate crisis is so huge that can you actually do something about it? And will what you do have an impact? And people feel a bit that it's so huge that anyway, their impact is not going to make much difference. So we want people to feel that it actually can make quite a big difference.
Cool. Thanks so much for all of these insights. I have a few final questions.
Sure.
What are your earliest memories?
Mine's falling off dad's scooter. I think it's just falling off it because, I don't know, he had an accident or something. I don't have the scar from that fall. That's my earliest memory. I think that was my first big fall. Yeah, in the middle of the street. So yeah, it was that's my earliest memory. The scar to show for it.
Mine, I don't know if it's my earliest memories, but we had a huge garden. So kind of some of the happy memories of my childhood are kind of playing in the garden. And we grew a lot of fruit and veg, kind of competitions with my sister of who could eat the highest number of berries. So yeah, that's kind
She's
of
happy,
quite a lot of happy memories.
Happy, positive memories. And I've got this, you know, a few negative memories. It shows our kind of mental state at this point in time. But anyway,
Cool. And then what's the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
Wow, there's so many. I think since the time we've kind of started Oddbox, there's been so many people who have helped us. Yeah. It's really hard to pick one specific person. I think it was, in a way, Pastor Des. He initially gave us that space in his kind of community hall and a church and actually believed in us. He was almost the first kind of person who believed in us. And he did it without any expectation.
We've had lots of people who've helped us. Especially at the start, just kind of sharing about Oddbox, giving their time.
So many people have done it without expecting anything in return. Yeah. And that's been a real big lesson, especially for me, coming from a very capitalistic kind of sector of giving, because you feel that you're contributing to something big.
Cool. Also, thank you so much for giving me your time and everyone listening. It's been some really insightful lessons.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Sam.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.